Today, we're going to cover a very significant topic. Probably the worst disease, in my opinion, in the world is the disease of addiction, because it influences negatively many more people than any other single disease. And my guest today is Dr. McGee, Michael McGee. He is the Chief Medical Officer of The Haven, which is a psychiatric treatment facility in Central Coast of California that specializes in the treatment of addiction. And Dr. McGee graduated and got his medical degree from Stanford University School of Medicine and did a residency at Harvard after that. And he has directed several treatment programs and participated in government-funded outcome research and has published in the areas of spirituality, addictions, and clinical treatment. He is board certified in general psychiatry, addiction psychiatry, and psychosomatic medicine. And his book that we're going to discuss today is called The Joy of Recovery, subtitled The New 12-Step Guide to Recovery from Addiction. Dr. McGee has a private practice going in San Luis Obispo, California, where he practices a combination of psychotherapy and psychopharmacology. His approach is eclectic. He includes psychospiritual interventions to complement biological, psychodynamic, interpersonal, and cognitive behavioral interventions. Michael, it's great to have you on the program today.
It's an honor to be talking with you.
I must admit, after going over your biological sketch, that last sentence not only confused me, but I know will confuse 100% of the people that are listening. So I'm going to give you an opportunity before we get started to explain it. And that statement is, his approach is eclectic. He includes psychospiritual interventions to complement biological, psychodynamic, interpersonal, and cognitive behavioral interventions.
That is a mouthful, and it is confusing. I appreciate the comment. As a psychiatrist, I'm trained in looking at the, as you are as a physician, Dr. Henderson, I'm trained to look at the body from a biological point of view. So let's take somebody, for example, with depression. If they're not able to sleep or concentrate or think or move or eat, the first approach would be to work on a neurobiological basis, maybe with an antidepressant medication as one option, to restore basic biological functioning to be able to eat and sleep and have enough energy to move. But after that, there are other levels of healing. Psychologically, there's the need for looking at things like negative thinking, cognitive distortions, thinking in a more positive and hopeful way. And there's the need for social connections and loving and belonging that need to be addressed. There are behavioral issues around basic self-care, getting exercise, getting time in nature, good nutrition. Mediterranean diet, for example, has been shown to be effective for helping with depression. So there's all sorts of psychological and behavioral components to healing from depression. Same thing with addiction. And then there are also spiritual components as well. For example, I have a patient who struggles with depression and addiction, who I just spoke with yesterday, who's doing fairly well. He's on an antidepressant, and is exercising and doing fairly well in school. But he still has a feeling of being burnt out and sort of lost, and a sense of apathy and lack of sense of meaning and purpose. And so for somebody like that, even though there is a biological component of treatment with the medication, we spent our session talking about the importance of the stillness practice and the importance of generating an attitude of wonder and appreciation through a meditative practice of still awareness, and the need, just like brushing your teeth every day, the need for a daily meditative practice. And I'm not sure that many psychiatrists actually do that kind of integrative work, but really that's so important in my work, which is to really integrate the spiritual with the biological, psychological, and social.
Well, Michael, thanks for explaining that to us. I knew the first way I said it wouldn't have come across, but that's a much better explanation. So, after reading your book, which is a great book, and I recommend people get it, The Joy of Recovery, The New 12-Step Guide to Recovery from Addiction, I noticed some striking differences between your concept of addiction and how to cure it and mine. And having said that, I believe that the best way to approach this interview is through a friendly debate. So I'll be bringing up points of debate, and then each of us will have an opportunity to respond, okay?
Sounds great. I'm looking forward to it.
Okay. Let's start off.
I also want to say that I'm also looking forward through this debate to the opportunity to learn and grow and take in some of your wonderful wisdom.
Well, thank you. That's an honor for you to think that, and I appreciate that. We'll get into why addiction treatment is not advanced in the next 50 years, and that will be one of the points. But let's start off with, we have a difference in our opinions on spirituality and religion. I think you told me in a pre-interview that yours was eclectic agnostic theist. And, of course, nobody is going to understand that. If that was right, if I got it right, would you explain it, and then I'll explain mine.
Sure, sure. I sort of appreciate the eclectic part is that I really appreciate a lot of the wisdoms and truths from multiple religious traditions, whether it be Hindu or Buddhist or Christian or Jewish or Muslim. To the degree to which I've learned and been exposed to them and understand them, I see that the truth can come in many different forms. My conviction is that there is one inexpressible, ineffable truth, and that that truth is that this universe is love, and that love is the guiding, ordering principle. But that truth comes, when it gets expressed imperfectly in words and thoughts and concepts, it comes out in different forms, and all the religions are different forms of trying to, in a clumsy way, express an inexpressible truth. And so that's the eclectic part. The agnostic part is that I really believe that for me religion is rooted in mystery. I don't think we can ever know the ultimate nature of being and of creation. I don't think that is really knowable. And so I'm not somebody who is really I'm very, as you know, in my book I have a chapter, a subsection called "Don't Believe Everything You Think," and I'm agnostically tentative, or I try to practice a sense of tentativeness around belief. In Zen tradition, there's the idea that opinions are the killers of life, and so I don't think we should hold on too tightly to beliefs or opinions about what I believe is ultimately mysterious and unknowable. And the theistic part is that I see us as intelligent, loving beings at our root, at our nature. And there, and I just have this conviction. It just feels right to me. Maybe this is a belief, but I have this knowing that intelligent, loving beings such as you and I, pieces of the universe, speaking to each other now through the phone, that this miracle of consciousness and of intelligent, loving existence must have some intelligent, loving force behind it that has led to the creation and existence of you and I having this conversation right now.
Okay. Now, my answer to that question is that I believe in a deity that created the universe, the world, and you and I. And I choose to call that deity God. And I choose to have a personal relationship with that deity on an ongoing daily basis. And I would say that that kind of sums up where I'm coming from. Would you like to say anything else, or we move on to the next point?
Well, I just want to say, Wynn, that I honor that and value that as one of many, many valid paths for spiritual growth. I myself go to a Unitarian church and to a Buddhist Sangha. And as part of my Unitarian tradition, I have friends and people I love in my life who have exactly the same spiritual path as you, and I honor that. It's not exactly the same as mine. I do know and experience that there is some unseen, intelligent, loving force, and I hear that you call that God. I tend to avoid the word God myself. It's okay. It's good. It's fine. But the word God, for me, it's almost like a word that is labeling something which really can't be even expressed in words. And so, although I honor and appreciate what you're saying, for me, I tend to avoid that word for those reasons.
Okay. The next point is the criteria we have for taking a new client to help him or her recover from addiction. What's your client, typical client, like? I mean, what are the criteria that you use to decide I'm going to treat you or I'm not going to treat you?
Oh, that's a good question. I think if somebody's coming to me wanting help, I and if they're willing to pay their fee and show up for their appointments and follow, the basic, rules of conduct in terms of safety for themselves and others, my initial approach is to sort of meet people where they're at and see what I can do to help them. I take sort of a patient-centered approach. If somebody comes to me using heroin, for example, and says, I really want to control my heroin usage. I don't want to give up my heroin usage, but I want to find a way to use heroin that won't, damage my life as much as it is. I want to be able to go out and work and function and have relationships. Then I don't think I would say to them, that won't work and I'm not going to treat you. But I would work with them around, in a patient-centered way. Around, if I felt it was possible to meet their goals. Now, if what somebody asked me I think is impossible and completely futile, then I think it's unethical to take somebody's money and to provide what you feel is futile treatment. But it's so important to engage in a patient-centered relationship where we meet people where they're at and help them sort of articulate for themselves what they want to achieve out of the treatment. And if it seems like it's reasonably possible to then help them, And for example, with my patient who wanted to continue to use heroin, after getting to the roots of her trauma, which included sexual abuse by her father, and this is, again, over a number of years of work, and going through some trauma work and some healing and grieving and consolidation and forgiveness and perspective taking and self-care and develop some more healthy emotional relationships in her life, her need for the heroin went away. And she eventually came to the point where, through her own choice, she said, I really don't want to be using heroin anymore. So I don't know if that gives you sort of a general sense, but that's sort of a sense of my perspective and approach towards helping people.
Okay. And the subpart to that is, since you will take anyone who wants your help, unless it's one of those criteria that you specified, do you have some kind of idea about what your cure rate from addiction is with your clientele?
You know, I yes and no. I have a buprenorphine practice for people with opioid use disorder, and I'd say that, and I've been treating people with opiate use disorder, heroin addiction mostly, for over 20 years, close to 30 years now. And over the past 20 years, I'd have to say that my rate of success is about 80% with that particular population. It's a little bit higher than the literature. The literature shows sort of a treatment effectiveness rate. The last time I read the literature with that medication, of about 65%. So I'm in my practice, I'm doing just a little bit better than the overall sort of published success rate. And another thing is defining success. I mean, if you're defining success as abstinence from using illicit opioids, that's one rate, and that's what I'm talking about in terms of this 80%, but that 80% also includes retaining people in treatment and helping them to develop happy, successful, fulfilling lives of love and integrity. And that, I'd say, is about, again, about a 70 to 80% rate of success with my practice.
Okay. Now, from my point of view, I don't take everybody that shows up and can pay. They have to have three qualifying criteria, in other words, to be able to use my service. And that is, first, they have to truly want to get well. There are so many people out there that will tell you that they want to get well, but actually they don't. And then the second criteria is, they have to believe that this treatment that you're going to be working with them will cure them. And the third criteria is they have to be willing to show up and do the work. And when I say that, my book, Freedom from Addiction 3, has a workbook part of it. It tells you what to do on a daily basis. And you have to make a decision. Do I want to be cured from addiction? Am I willing to put in 30 minutes a day? So those are the three criteria. Now, having said that, if a client says that all these three things are justified in their case and they go through this therapy program, I have no failures. I have 100% cure rate, but quite often, on the back end, I see that they didn't do one of the three things. So that puts the total responsibility on the person, because I have every reason to believe that if they did those three things, they could be absolutely cured from their addiction. And I don't mean just the one that's giving them the most problem right now, because things like the 12-step program substitutes one addiction for another, saying, our addictions are not as bad as your addiction. So, and we can't cure you, but if you keep coming back, we can keep you away from whatever the addictive behavior is that you're doing now that's not working well in your life. So that's another part of it. And would you like to respond to that, or we go on?
Sure. Just to briefly respond. I just finished reading your book, Wynn, and I read about those three criteria, and you're absolutely right. I think that that people have to. Everybody I see wants to feel good and not feel bad. Everybody wants happiness, but when they come to us, sometimes they're very confused about how to truly achieve an end of suffering and happiness. And sometimes they want some. They don't really want a change. They want something to be done to them that will then take away their pain. But they really aren't willing to work to change. And I think the reason why I love doing addiction psychiatry work is because if you do the work, it works. And I'd say about half of our patients in our treatment program come to us with that willingness to do whatever they need to do to work on their recovery every day. And if they have that willingness, like you said, they get better. But if they don't have that willingness, if there's laziness, if there's just sort of that fear or just sort of this holding on to the way things are, if you don't change your behavior, you're not going to change the consequences of your behavior. And so I really agree with you and honor and appreciate what you're saying about these important components for success in treatment.
Well, Michael, I would like to help cure everybody, but I know that that's not possible.
That's right.
In my particular way of taking care of it, I know that if the people don't believe or won't do those three things, I'm wasting their time and they're wasting mine. And
right.
Addiction is the biggest illness in the world, in my opinion. Practically everybody has it unless they've developed increased spiritual consciousness to the point that they can get rid of it. And so there's more work out there that I could do in 40 lifetimes. And I just try
that's true.
You know, and I just try to pick the people that I think, you know, would benefit from learning what I've learned over the last 30, 40 years. And, you know, a lot of it gets down to, have you sunk so low in your life that you're willing to do anything to stop the pain and the suffering? Or do you just think, well, you know, I have some bad times, but I have some fun times too, and it's not that critical yet. Problem being with opioid or narcotic type of addictions, and we treat all kinds of behavioral addictions, but this particular one that's getting a lot of play in the news and everything, because it's being compromised by putting really potent narcotics in it so that the drug people can make more money, you don't know from one time to the next whether you're going to live through the experience. And if you don't,
that's right. It's a lethal addiction.
Absolutely. And you might go for 10 years and never die, but maybe the next time you will. And
that's right. Especially with fentanyl now and the heroin, there's such an increased risk of mortality because you just don't know what you're getting sometimes.
Absolutely. And so that's. That's something that's widely discussed in the media and everything, but that's not the most common addictions. And I believe all addictions come from the same place, have the same cause, can be treated the same way with the same recovery type statistics. And I see that the biggest single addiction today in this country is screen addiction. People are addicted to their phones, their their video games, their television, their computers, and their life is miserable because of this particular addiction. And normally when I talk to people and they ask me what I do, they think I treat drugs, alcohol, and tobacco. And I will, of course, but there are so many more common things to treat that that is just like the tip of the iceberg to me. Okay.
I really appreciate what you're saying. I think that technology addiction is epidemic. Even watching TV, I would add to that. There are people who spend hours and hours just passively watching TV. And I see that as also an addictive behavior as well.
Yeah. So some people think only of substance abuse of addiction, but it's really into any kind of behavior which meets certain criteria, and we'll go into that next. Can I have our definitions of first spirituality?
Sure. Would you like me to give my definition?
Sure.
So spirituality, this is something actually I'm just finishing publishing an article for Alcoholism Treatment Quarterly, which is a fairly well-known journal. And my review article is entitled Awakening and Recovery. And I go over sort of clinical definitions and reviews of spirituality. And there's a particular study by a gentleman, by a researcher named McClintock, which I really, really appreciated, that sort of synthesized in a really beautiful way what spirituality is. He did a worldwide survey of all cultures from all countries around an analysis of how people understood their spirituality. And he came up, surprisingly, with five universal components of spirituality. And I'll just go through those because I think they're so relevant. The first component is the experience of transcendence or unity, the experience of the ultimate reality, which can't be expressed in words, but which is so true, which is that we are all one, and there is oneness. There is just one reality of which we are all a part. We are all interdependent, and we are all interbeing with one another. And the experience of separateness, the ego experience of separateness, is an illusion. So that's the first pillar or cornerstone of spirituality, is oneness. And from that comes the second principle, which is the experience of love or reverence. It's an attitude of reverent appreciation and worship for the sacredness of life and of existence. So that principle is love. So there's oneness, and then the second principle is love or reverence. And then the third principle, which is the second part of love, actually, is altruism. The third principle is that out of our reverence for life, we devote our lives to it, to nurturing life. So there's, in a way, the second principle of love or reverence is one of savoring existence. And then the third principle of altruism is one of nurturing existence. And there's only two other principles. The fourth principle that's universal to all spirituality is this idea of spiritual practice. And I see that as the practice of stillness. It's either prayer or meditation or Tai Chi or Qigong or yoga, or for me, a walking meditation, being still in nature, but some sort of practice of silence, solitude, and stillness, what I call in my book the Triple S practice. So that's the fourth principle, which is practice. So we have oneness, love, altruism, spiritual practice. And the final practice, the fifth universal principle of all spirituality around the world, is the issue of reflection and contemplation. It's the idea of stepping back and reflecting on one's life. That might be reading spiritual literature. It might be journaling. It just might be quiet contemplation. And I know you write about this in your book, too, Wynn, about the importance of reflection and contemplation as a principle of spirituality. So those are the five principles. There's oneness, love, altruism, spiritual practice and reflection and contemplation. And you'll notice that in that definition, if you look at the realization of those principles, the way that I know spirituality is there's a sense of being harmoniously a part of something greater than ourselves. It's being in a harmonious, loving, humble relationship with reality. And that really, for me, summarizes spirituality. And you'll notice that in this universal definition that has been sort of verified throughout the world, there's no mention of belief and there's no mention of God. So for me, even though I know that there's some sort of intelligent, loving force at play that has led to the manifestation of you and I talking on the phone today, it's a knowing that is not necessarily a need for God. So I think the difference between you and I is that, for example, I can see the Dalai Lama as a highly realized spiritual being who doesn't necessarily have a sense of God. And the same is true for a billion people who practice Buddhism who are deeply spiritual in their nature, but who don't necessarily have a sense of a transcendent being.
Well, Michael, that was a very, very good discussion of spirituality, and I don't disagree with anything that you said. However, as I look back over my time in addiction, which has been 30, 40 years, something like that, and I look at things like the 12-step program, and I wrote a book on the 12-step program and explained it and revised it 20 years ago. But the thing that I had against that way of looking at spirituality is that they would only call it a, quote, higher power, quote. And a higher power could be a tree. So that's why, in my opinion, that the 12-step program never says that they can cure addiction, because they can't, and that you can just be in recovery, and if you'll do our program, that'll be better than if you were doing the behavior or substance abuse that you're doing right now. And so that's why I have problems with spirituality in that sense, in that I think it's great, but I don't think it's totally the answer. And as you know, I believe the answer is one being, one deity that created the heavens and the earth and created you and I. And if we can recognize that person and get into alignment with that person, which I call God, then we have a chance of doing anything and everything. And recovering is, in my way of looking at it, is curing the disease and not the behavior, because, as you know, you can cure behavior, but then people quite often just go on to some other addictive behavior because they haven't cured the disease. So that's the way I think about that. Okay. The definition of addiction. Can I have your definition first, and then I'll give you mine?
Sure. So I have a very simple, I can give you two definitions. The very simple one is compulsive good now, bad later. Compulsively doing something that feels good now that ultimately is bad later. And I think that really sums up addiction very simply. And I use that definition with my patients because my patients get it. It's like, oh, if I get drunk now, it'll feel good now, but it'll be bad later when I can't go to work tomorrow. So immediate, you know, positive reinforcement with long-term negative consequences. I think that, you know, the more formal definition is compulsion, loss of control, leading to adverse consequences. So a behavior which is compulsive, where there's impaired control, there's a loss of some degree of being able to control your behavior, leading to adverse consequences. I know one of my addictions is to kettle potato chips. And if my wife Linda brings those home and puts them in the cupboard, There have been times where I've compulsively watched myself go, even though I'm full, and pull out those potato chips and watch myself eat the entire bag of potato chips, saying to myself as I'm eating these, this is not good for me. This is not good food. This is not healthy. I'm going to gain weight because of this, and this is bad. I shouldn't be doing this. But yet I still continue to eat the potato chips. So that's really my definition, is sort of compulsively doing good now, bad later.
Okay. I just want to ask you a question before I get into my side of the discussion on this point. Is the clinical psychiatric disease called obsessive compulsive disease, in your opinion, addictive behavior, addiction, you know, is the way that the rest of us look at it?
That's a really good question. In many ways, yes. In many ways, it does have a lot of similar qualities too. Now, remember, from the official point of view of the American Psychiatric Association and the Diagnostic and Statistician's Manual version 5, the DSM-5, the word addiction isn't even used officially in our profession. There's no such thing as addiction. And that's a problem I have with our profession, is that we've shied away from using the word addiction even. There are substance use disorders, but there's no such thing as food addiction. There's no such thing as sex addiction. There's no such thing as work addiction. In your book, you talk about, consumer addiction or spending addiction. You've talked about screen addiction, technology addiction. None of those things exist in the official diagnostic world. And your point about obsessive compulsive disorder, that's not even seen as an addiction officially. But you're right. If somebody, for example, is compulsively washing their hands to take away the feeling of being contaminated, they're doing something that's good now for relief. It's a behavior that's relieving a pain, and they're doing it compulsively without control, and it's resulting in negative consequences in terms of raw hands or cracked hands and excessive time spent washing. So in those ways, I do see OCD behaviors as kind of an addictive behavior.
Okay. Now, for my definition of addiction, I wrote about this many years ago, even decades, and it has served me well in the therapy that I do with my patients, and that is, if you have a behavior, any behavior, which you come to realize is harming you or harming someone you love, and you can't stop it for whatever reason, then you're addicted to that behavior. And you made a point of talking about if one felt deep reverence for one's life and the lives of others, would you do something to harm yourself or them? And that's sort of what gets down to the crux of that definition.
That's a beautiful definition. That is, I love your definition, Wynn. That is such a good definition. And your point is so good. I think you and I probably feel the same way, that I see the root of recovery being love. And I see love as the same as spirituality. Or just that one of those central components of spirituality that arises from the experience of oneness and unity. And it's out of reverence. I mean, if we truly felt reverence for ourselves and others, and if we truly knew the experience, the truth, which is that this moment is sacred and you are sacred and I are sacred, then we wouldn't do anything that is sort of good now, bad later, something that relieves us in this moment. That causes pain for ourselves or others in the long term.
Absolutely. Okay, the cause of addiction. You know, we've both been trained in medical school, and I think that our training said you need to find the cause of the disease before you can treat it effectively. And I think one of the biggest reasons that we're having problems in the world is because people don't understand what the cause of addiction is. So could I have your thoughts?
Okay. First of all, I think it's a mistake to think that there is one cause. I think that that addiction is much more complex than that, and that there can be multiple etiologies of compulsive good now, bad later behavior. So there can be biological contributing, and I think it's better to think in terms of contributing factors that lead to a syndrome. So for example, if you have a headache, that headache could be caused by multiple things. But the behavioral syndrome, psychological behavioral syndrome of addiction, can have multiple contributing factors. So for example, there's a genetic vulnerability. Some people, I had this one patient who just had a profound genetic vulnerability to the dysregulating behavioral aspects of opioids. She was had no trauma, a happy life, a brilliant woman, graduated from college early at the age of 18, was working as a senior editor for a publishing agency, leading a successful, happy life, and she happened to take some OxyContin at a party. And the next thing you know, a year later, she was under a bridge, homeless, using heroin. And what was the cause of that for her? And it was clearly, if you looked at the biological, psychological, social, and spiritual, etiological factors, the cause was really her genetic vulnerability to addiction. And there was just a neurobiological dysregulation. Now, there are epidemiologists and geneticists who have devoted their lives to looking at the genetic contributing factors to addiction. And they range from about 40% a genetic influence for hallucinogens up to about a 70% genetic influence for opioids, cocaine, and methamphetamine. So we see a range of genetic contributions. Some people just aren't genetically vulnerable to addiction. They can have a cigarette one day and then put it down and another one 2 days later and never feel a compulsion. And other people just are genetically vulnerable to the dysregulating effects on their drive reward system and just become intensely addicted almost immediately. I've had patients, for example, with alcohol use disorder who just, if they have one drink, they're done. They're gone. And they could be leading happy, loving lives, spiritually intact, and everything. But if they had that one drink, they're completely gone. At the other end of the extreme are people who maybe don't have so much of a genetic vulnerability, but maybe they're disconnected. Maybe they're spiritually empty. Maybe they have this yearning, as we all do, for something more, for a sense of joy and fulfillment and meaning and purpose and belonging. And if those are lacking, those can contribute to compulsive good now bad behavior as a way of trying to self-medicate or relieve that pain. The other thing we see is that with people with psychiatric illnesses have much higher rates of addiction, ADHD, bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, all of these different major depressive disorder, generalized anxiety disorder, social anxiety disorder, all of these psychiatric illnesses create problems with impulsivity, pain and suffering. And because of the pain and suffering, there's this increased, drive to feel better. We all want to feel good and not feel bad. And so if we're feeling bad in some way due to psychiatric reasons, that can also be another etiological factor that can drive our descent into addiction.
Well, I can appreciate where you're coming from. However, I like to keep it simple, stupid. And my way of doing that is that I've seen over the last 40 years that everybody in my focus has the same underlying cause of addiction. And I haven't found this to not be the case. Everybody, if I probe deep enough into them, does. And That is low self-esteem, not valuing yourself as much as you should, and that comes from lack of spiritual understanding. Because if you had the spiritual understanding of who you really are, where your place in the universe is, how valuable you are, you wouldn't have the low self-esteem, and the low self-esteem causes you to go out into society to look for something to make you feel better, and most of those things that are common and available are bad for you. So, from my simplistic viewpoint, low self-esteem is the cause of addiction, and that's how I try to help people, which is to improve their self-esteem through increasing their spiritual consciousness.
That's beautiful, and I really, really, that is so true for most of the people who I treat. What you're saying is exactly true. There's a sense of a lack of a sense of reverence and a sense of knowing our sacredness. And if we really knew how sacred we are, if we really experienced the truth of that, we would do nothing to harm ourselves, and we wouldn't need to because we would feel so full. This moment is enough. In fact, this moment is more than enough. This moment is abundantly amazing. And when you take away that pain of lack of self-love, then you take away a big driver of addiction. At the same time, there can be people who, for example, have a sense of their sacredness, but maybe I've seen patients who are really well evolved and very spiritual who continue to smoke, for example, and they just are driven by the compulsion of the nicotine. It's purely a biological thing that they just can't overcome the compulsion to treat that every 2 hour nicotine withdrawal by taking in more nicotine, and it's overwhelmingly compulsive. And even the knowing that it's wrong and knowing that they are sacred and knowing that they feel good about themselves, they just have a real hard time with stopping. So I think you're right, but I also think that, again, I go back to that this is a complex syndrome that has multiple etiological factors.
Okay. I don't really want to get into talking about you, but you did say I'm addicted to chips, right?
I've got a couple of addictions, actually.
And you said, I know that it's bad for me, but I can't stop it. I know that it might make me fat, you know, it might decrease my length of time on the planet and everything, but I can't stop it. So don't you fit the definition of what I just said, which is you don't value yourself enough?
Well, see, in that moment, you what you're saying is right, that the addiction takes over. It's a compulsive thing that takes over. Even if you do value yourself, the nature of addiction is that in that moment, you're really in your behavior. You're not, I wasn't valuing myself. So, and this is where recovery comes in, when it's so important that people humbly acknowledge that really there's a need for some sort of something greater than themselves. I don't like the word higher power as much as I do the sense greater power, that we are part of one greater interdependent interbeing web of life and love, and that we really need to reach out and tap into that greater love that we are a part of in order to heal from addiction. I believe that to be true. So for me, with my food addiction, I just know that neurobiologically that I need to stay away from carbohydrates. They are addictive for me. And as long as I stay on a good diet and stay connected and to my support network of loving people, to sort of help be accountable and transparent about what I'm doing with my diet, and if I'm clear with my daily morning intentions to to eat a healthy diet and stay away from carbohydrates, I'm fine. And for me, that's the practice of reverence for myself, is really the daily practice of affirmations and intentions, giving my life over. Every day I start by, in my meditation and prayer, by saying, today, may I please be a channel of love. May I please, I surrender and give myself over to being a channel and an instrument of love, and that I may benefit others in the world, and that I may also take very good care of myself. And it's with that kind of that reverence and that accountability and that transparency that I'm able to then not eat chips.
Okay. So you read my book, and you remember maybe reading about the four spiritual questions, that if you can answer them and apply those answers to your life, that you'll have a totally different life than you would have had otherwise. And
yeah.
And the third question is, what am I doing here? In other words, why am I here on this planet? And my belief is that each of us, all 7+ billion people, have a purpose. They're not here just by accident. That they have a mission, a purpose, something, a destiny to fulfill. And if somehow or the other they can figure out what that is and start doing it, they'll have a lot less or no problems with addictive behaviors to try to pull them off course. Because, you know, like, there was a time when I got in my sports car and just started tooling down the highway and maybe speeding, I don't know, but whatever. And I didn't think about the fact that by not putting on a seatbelt, I was increasing my chance of dying. And then when I put it together, I've got a purpose, a mission here, and if I don't do what I need to do, like putting on a seatbelt or not eating the chips or whatever it might be, I'm not going to make it to be able to fulfill my mission. So therefore, I can't do these various things. And so it's restrictive, yes, but if that's your belief pattern, it takes you a lot longer way of approaching your value in life by giving up some of the things that you know is not good for you. See how that works?
You know, yeah. You know, I love what you're saying. And I do think that one of the four I do believe in your four spiritual principles, and the idea of living for a higher purpose is so, so essential to recovery. And then, and I talk about this in my book, about the issue of renunciation, which is a controversial thing. If you read writers like Anthony DeMello, for example, he really sees awakening in the spiritual path as not involving renunciation, but just awareness and realization. But I think of it differently. And I think what you're saying is so true, that when I renounce addicting, it's because I'm exchanging it for something even better. And that's your third spiritual principle, which is I renounce addicting so that I can devote my life to something much greater and more fulfilling, which is fulfilling my purpose on this planet.
Right. Well, Michael, there were a couple of other things that I wanted to talk about, but we've run out of time, unfortunately. Your book, The Joy of Recovery, is available at Amazon, and your website, you want to give them that address?
Sure. TheJoyOfRecovery.com will get people to my website, which is really drmichaelmcgee.com is my website.
Well, Michael, it's been a pleasure to talk with you for the last hour, and I think that this discussion will, depending on how many people hear it, will be of great value. So thanks so much for the time that you spent with me today, and hopefully we'll get a chance to talk again in the future.
I hope so. Thank you for the opportunity, and it's been great getting to know you and reading your book, and I appreciate the wonderful work you're doing for the world.
Thank you.